All right, so we are continuing on talking to these great speakers in YAL 2012. Please introduce yourself.
My name is Jaffer Hussain. I'm a senior developer at Netflix.
Excellent. Now, you have an interesting history having been at Microsoft.
Right.
And another interesting history being a big fan of RX.
Big fan.
Excellent. Now, it just so happens that, you know, you use RX in the real world in your Netflix app.
Absolutely.
Talk to us about that.
So first thing I exported when I left Microsoft and came to Netflix was RX. They, as a matter of fact, they were facing the exact same problems that I think a lot of people on the web are facing, trying to coordinate a bunch of different async tasks. And the thing is, at Netflix, we use JavaScript and WebKit to target a large number of mobile devices, set-top boxes, gaming platforms, and WebKits are key to doing that economically. And so, being a single-threaded language, we have to deal with asynchrony. And they were running into those issues, and so I was sort of, my timing was perfect entering Netflix because, you know, I just said, hey, here's this great framework we can use. And it's really a success story because, you know, now I think about a year later, Netflix, RX is powering, you know, our Wii platform, it's powering our Xbox, our Windows 8 platform, it's powering our PS3 platform, and there's reason to believe in the near future it's going to power our Xbox platform. Furthermore, we're probably going to do our own port of the server so we can run it in the back end now that RX is open sourced.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's underway right now.
Awesome, and that's the power of open sourcing RX. So talk to us a little bit, for the people in the audience who aren't RX developers, they heard a lot about this on Channel 9. We give them a lot of the theory and the monadic structure and the duality of it all. From a pragmatic engineering perspective, talk to us a little bit. What is RX, man?
Well, so what Eric and his team did, which is so brilliant, is that they took a look at the iterator pattern, which is something so well understood that's everywhere. And they just took a look at it, at that interface, and they said, hey, you know what? If we sort of turn this interface inside out, which is what the process they call dualizing, and turn it from a pull instead of I ask you for information and you give it back to me into a push interface, well then we've got something that's awfully like the observer pattern, which is another really well understood design pattern there from the Gang of Four. But by adding two little things to the observer pattern, one, a way of saying from the producer to the consumer, I'm done, I got no more data for you, and the second, a way of saying from the producer to the consumer, there was an error that happened, they were able to unify the observer pattern and the iterator pattern in a very deep level. And so what that means pragmatically to you is that all the ways in which we already know how to manipulate iterators, like you know, link, fantastic example, select where, and in the JavaScript world, we have the closest thing we have is arrays, and that's map, filter. Anything you can do to those data structures, you can now do to asynchronous programs. And that has such wide-ranging implications. Again, in JavaScript, where it's a single-threaded language and we have to deal with asynchrony all the time, just something as simple as sequencing async operations. And if you have an issue, if something explodes and you have to roll back, the language doesn't help you. If you're in synchronous code, try-catch does that for you. But if you're in asynchronous code, you're sort of left to your own devices. Mm. So RX just gives you a really powerful way of now sequencing async operations, which is so much of what's done in web applications, and combining that together with events. And this is where RX really differs from existing platforms, for existing solutions in the JavaScript world for asynchronous programming, because there are some out there. Most of all, they focus on scalar values. So I have some computation, and then you call me back with one result, which is great for modeling async calls, sequencing async calls. And you see a lot of that in the Node.js world. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing is they're focusing on a specific problem, sort of like how we ended up with the observer pattern in the first place, where the Gang of Four was focusing on solving UI events. They engineered to a specific problem, and they came up with an interface. And now, I think in the JavaScript world, there's some frameworks out there that are engineering for a specific problem, this nested callback structure we see again and again in Node.js apps and in web apps, and they're trying to solve that one problem. But what Eric's done is, by really focusing on the fundamentals, he solved two problems at the same time. He solved event-driven programming, and he solved sequencing these async operations in such a way that you can unify them both. Hmm. Because after all, almost everything in a web application starts with an event, then that triggers an async request. So having a type that can model the two of those and then compose them together is huge.
Absolutely. Now, how long did it take you to grok RX?
You know, truthfully, I had a little bit of functional programming background going in. But the truth is, I don't want to, you know, put rose-colored glasses on anybody. RX takes a while to understand. You know, if you come from the background which I did, which was up until a few years before RX came along, before Link, really, which was one of my first introductions to functional programming, you're really looking at a very different style of thinking about solving problems, very imperative, loops and sets. But after a while, if you're willing to sort of stick with it and willing to give yourself a little bit of time to learn the technology and to learn to really think differently, problems that seem very, very difficult can become very, very easy. And so one of the things we've been doing is, you know, there's all these questions about whether functional programming can work in an enterprise. And I think in that respect, Netflix is a really great success story because we came in, when I came into Netflix, I was the only RX guy. And now it's absolute required learning for every member of our development team, at least on the TVUI team. Wow. And certainly, if you write server scripts, you're going to have to know RX as well. And so at first, you know, there was a learning curve, and we addressed that ourselves actually with some training programs. And I think the outcome of that has been overwhelmingly positive. There's a lot of enthusiasm internally for the technology, and you know, nowadays I get to build products that millions of people literally use with reactive programming. So it's a really exciting, it's a dream job.
That's really awesome, and it's scaling. I mean, it's working great.
Absolutely. Right? I mean, the exciting thing is that, you know, we have built our own next, again, great timing coming into Netflix. They were really rethinking how they were doing their client-server interaction model. And, you know, it was the perfect time to come in and sort of talk about how RX could be a great API, right, for handling that client-server communication. And we've built our own sort of next-gen data platform on top of RX. We've used it as a building block to do that.
Excellent, man. And so let's talk about that aspect, because I think in some sense, not everybody, at least not all of the developers in a product, would need to know the details of RX if you kind of abstracted those details away with a shell around it.
Right.
Such that, you know, I think most developers grok, at least the C-sharp guys, sort of the link syntax, right?
Right.
Lark, you know, RX is like link to events, link to streams, which is one way that it was described early on.
Right.
Because you use link, you use lambdas, right?
Mm-hmm.
So talk to me about that aspect of it when you use RX underneath an API and what you surface to the consumer.
Well, so we don't hide RX. In fact, so we played with that, right? For a while, we were thinking, you know what, to scale in terms of learning, training, maybe it would be just easier if we can hide this. The truth is, you can't hide RX because you end up surfacing the same semantics in some isomorphic way, right? You still got to signal errors. You still got to signal that there's data there. The truth is, the interface itself, which is what we surface, right, in response to a query, we'll surface that interface. That's not terribly hard to grok. I don't think the observable is really any harder to grok than IEnumerable. What's difficult, I think, is getting to learn how to put those together to consume asynchronous programs. But that's the beauty of using RX, which is I can hand developers observables. And in a worst case scenario, they consume it the exact same way they consume UI events today. And they don't really take advantage of the composition. But after time, they become more comfortable with the technology, then you're already set up because you have all these different iObservable data sources. And when developers are ready, when they're actually ready to take it to the next level of composition, well, then they find all of a sudden that they're surrounded by these data sources that are extremely powerful and that they can use these powerful compositional operators to put them together.
Awesome. Let's talk about the compositional operators and composition in general. What do you mean?
Well, so for example, you know, here's our data access platform really focuses on data virtualization, which is to say you have this huge amount, this maybe conceptual model on the server, this huge amount of data, but you can only afford to keep a tiny amount on the client. Some of the clients that we target are very, very small. You know, they're very, very lightweight. We don't have a lot of memory. So it's really fundamentally a data virtualization problem, right? We're creating the illusion to the user that they have all this data there on the client, just that they're just thumbing through, when in reality what's going on is we're sort of pulling parts of that conceptual model onto the client. And that's the problem that we sort of tried to fundamentally solve here. And so, you know, even just going from the UI interaction model where you're going left, left, right, and we have left, right, up, down devices like Netflix is integrated into televisions. So as you scroll to the right, we might make a request. But then if you keep scrolling right, 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 we might want to forget about that request. And then there's these operators like take until, which is an incredibly powerful operator. I can say, hey, give me this data stream until maybe they've scrolled this far, and then I don't care about it anymore. And if it's in a queue, for example, we might not even end up making that request.
Yeah.
So little things like that, all the way down to the UI, right? But all the way, you know, from the server all the way down to the UI, we're using, first of all, we're using iObservable in the framework itself, which includes sort of a caching layer that makes that sort of transparent to the user. So the developer. So right before, we as developers had to focus very hard on creating this illusion that all the data was on the client. Now we have a framework that provides the same illusion to developers. So they just ask for data, and it transparently gets cached. It might come from the cache, might come from the back end. And that's what iObservable did for us, because the interface allows us, because it's push. Push is the lowest common denominator of all data sources, right? You got local storage, it's synchronous. But I can model it as a push. I just hand you a callback, and you immediately call it. It's still synchronous, but it's push-based because the producer is in control of the operation. In-memory objects, again, synchronous, but I can model it as a push operation. But then you come to asynchronous data sources, and they have to be push because, at least in the JavaScript world, they have to be push because they're async APIs. So just by using Observable, that was what Observable allowed us to do. Abstract the true source of the data from the developer instead of having the developer work really hard to abstract the true source of the data for the actual user.
Excellent, man. Really, really cool. Now, was it all rosy?
I would say the most challenging part was the learning curve. And it was about figuring out the right way to message Rx to developers, right? I think that there was some challenges at first around developers. Yeah, I mean, anytime you're exposing them to new technology and you're putting them in situations where all these developers are on deadlines, you know, they're concerned about the risk. But it's about being there, really, to help them through that process. And I think that there, you know, initially, I think there were some concerns about the technology and concerns about any complexity involved with it. And my feeling is now that we've got the right training courses in place, and there's a certain confidence that there are people in the organization who now actually have quite a bit of knowledge, not just myself, built up around Rx, who are willing to help developers through that process. I think you're starting to see that fear disappear, and people are really now embracing the technology. I now get more people coming to me excited about what Rx can do for them and showing me, hey, I can do this with it, right? Mm-hmm. Rather than initially coming to me and say, how do I do this? I still get a bit of that, and we have different developers at sort of different places in the learning curve. But at this point, I would call it a success because we've built, you know, we've built serious reactive programs on top of this technology.
That is just really killer to hear, man. Because there's so many. I know there's a lot of people out there watching this that have watched a lot of Channel 9 interviews, and certainly Rx has been high on the sort of radar of primetime Channel 9. But Netflix is huge, man. You guys are like built on Rx, the TV aspect of it, the services.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, millions and millions of subscribers. We're at peak times, we're responsible for a third of all of US traffic, downstream traffic.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a great place to work if you want to build reactive programs that millions and millions of people use. It's really exciting stuff.
Absolutely. And to see that, in fact, Rx actually scales to millions and millions of users. Cool. So what else do you do there? So it sounds to me like you're sort of an architect at Netflix.
We have a flat... We have a flat title structure at Netflix.
Okay.
Everyone's a senior developer. But, you know, they allow people to... I've been very fortunate. I had a manager who gave me a lot of confidence and trust. And I was sort of given that task of putting together that data virtualization framework. And, you know, that's the type of culture that we have at Netflix. It's freedom and responsibility. So I was given enough rope to hang myself with. And, you know, I think... That allowed me to do, to some degree, the kind of job that an architect does, because I was given that freedom. You know, I sat down and I tried to think deeply about the problem that we were solving, and I'm very happy with the outcome, and I hope certainly that my colleagues and the other devs on my teammates are happy with the framework. I think we're starting to see some real productivity benefits from this framework. It's Rx that really makes it possible. It's sort of the building block. Because once you have that asynchronous iterator, well, there's a lot of data structures, right? Now, if there's an asynchronous iterator, there must then be an asynchronous list. And in our case, there must be an asynchronous map. So an asynchronous map is basically the model that we use for our our data virtualization framework, because JSON's just a map. So you can have some of it there and you can have some of it over here. But as long as it's reactive, as long as it's built on iObservable, right? So you can request a portion, a segment of that conceptual model, but it's wrapped in an iObservable to make it asynchronous. And so there's really, we've just sort of begun, I think, to see all of the great things you can do with Rx, because it's really just the first step. There's a lot of data structures out there.
Absolutely. Now, have you played around at all with iQObservable?
I haven't played with it. You know, the truth is, I don't write much C# code anymore.
Okay.
There is a very talented dev on our team at Netflix, Matt Arnold, who has worked on the port of our data virtualization framework for the Windows 8 client.
Great.
And that's using Rx on Windows 8. And so, you know, he gets to write all those awesome, you know, elegant link statements.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong, JavaScript's a great language for doing Rx, right? Yeah. But in C#, you know, it's pretty darn elegant. Of course, you get to use link. Mm-hmm. But he's done a fantastic job of picking up the technology. Great example, actually, of a guy didn't come in with any Rx technology, picked it up very quickly, built a great framework on top of it, and now we're using it in our Windows 8 client.
That's awesome, man, which is actually a nice app.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I take no credit. The team behind it, very talented group of devs.
Absolutely. But, you know, you did help get Rx into that.
Yes, I have been pushing very, very hard. Yeah, I mean, it just solves too many of the problems that we were facing not to use it. And I mean, you know, I'm obviously a big fan of Rx, and those who have maybe seen, I did a talk before Channel 9 when I was working for Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't just come in there, I promise you, trying to push Rx on Netflix. They really were facing those problems. And I have no doubt that a huge number of different software companies are really facing the same problems around asynchrony, coordinating async tasks, and could really benefit from Rx. And my hope is now that it's open source, all those barriers really go away. I mean,
sure. And you know, I guess open source also, you know, in two senses. The sense from the perception perspective, because it's open source, whether or not you actually open the source
right,
and look at it or modify it.
Mm-hmm.
And open source for when you actually have to crack it open and modify it to help extend to a very specific scenario.
Right.
Which I think, you know, I could see that having to happen for big data problems where, you know, that's sort of why, that's why NIAID was created from MSR, and they didn't use Rx because they didn't want to crack open Rx. They didn't quite grok it enough to crack it open and rewrite some of its internals to solve their problem, so they just did their own thing.
Right.
But absolutely understand that, and I think it's a brilliant move. I also love the fact that there's now Rx for C++ developers.
Yes.
So if you have any of those in the house at Netflix?
We you know, it's not, I don't think there's as much native code right now. We're, you know, right now our iOS app is actually a WebKit app, right? But who knows? Maybe sometime in the future that would change.
Mm.
I'm actually in awe that we've managed to, you know, push Rx to C++. I think very functionally, and that tends to involve a garbage collector. So I actually am very interested to see how that model works in the native world.
Mm.
I know somebody out there has already ported it to Objective-C. So, you know,
really?
You should know that there's a dev out there who works for GitHub. In order to make, you know, Rx work at GitHub, they ported it, this code that's called Reactive Cocoa.
Okay.
You know, people are making the Rx model work in native code, which is exciting.
Absolutely. Hey man, great to talk to you, Jafar.
Yeah.
And you guys do great things. So I know that everybody out there who uses the Netflix app, know that there's Rx in there, man.
Your Rx is running like
Rx in the real world.
Oh! I was hey. Just walking by here.
Hey, man.
Your Rx from Jafar. That can only be trouble.
Awesome, man. Eric's
hey,
here.
Hey, Jafar.
Hi. How's it going, Eric?
Good.
Perfect, man.
Yeah.
So can you? It's amazing. They used Rx in Netflix.
Yes, isn't that fantastic?
Yes, it is. And we were just talking about how his implementation details.
Yeah,
of course, you put your thing on again, so let's take that off because it's too nerdy, dude. All right, cool. So
I mean, we took a look. You know, the question we asked ourselves is, now that we have the asynchronous iterator, so to speak, we've turned that pattern around. Well, there's other data structures, right? That's just the beginning. And you can use that as sort of the building block to make your asynchronous list and your asynchronous map and so on and so forth. And that's basically what we did. We built an asynchronous map with a coarse-grained API, and it returns observables.
Awesome, man. Excellent.
Now, this is beautiful because this is turned into asynchronously. It's turned into an expert to expert.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Asynchronously, yeah. Hey, so what you're doing when you're returning a collection of results, you turn that into an observable stream? Is that what you're doing?
That's exactly right. The most straightforward representation of a push map would be string goes in, maybe task of map comes out, right? Or task of object, really, right? Because it could be a scalar value, or a value type, that is. But then, you know, we didn't have task of T in JavaScript, so we went with string goes in. Then the next sort of approach would be string goes in, I observable of object comes out.
Yep.
But then that's, since we need to go over the wire, and once again, we don't have the great functionality that we have available in the C#, where we can take code and turn it into data, and then remote a very long expression. We had to make one final modification, which is we allow you to pass in a list of string, right? And then from that, or actually a list of strings, so several paths through a map, deep paths through a map, and then out from that comes back an iObservable of a tuple of the path that's coming back, the location in the map, and then the object itself.
Okay.
And so using iObservable allowed us to do two things. One, it allowed us to process, you know, multiple paths on the server in parallel and then have them come back in you know, all different orders asynchronously.
And then you reassemble them based on the paths?
Right, exactly. Okay. We create a smaller fragment of that large server model on the client. And then the second thing, a really big deal for us, was it allowed us to use right now, developers have to work very hard to create this illusion to users, which is that all the data just exists on the client. I mean, that's most of what client-server applications do. They have work hard to make it seem like to the user that all that data that's out there in the cloud's right there.
Of course, yeah.
But we wanted to create the same abstraction for the developer. We wanted to have the developer not necessarily know whether data was coming from cache or isolated storage or network. And so, because iObservable is a push-based interface, which is absolutely the lowest common denominator, right? Then I can hide that detail from the developer because they always code reactively, and then who knows? They don't even know where the data comes from.
And so, but you said like when you're sending the path to the server, did you think of sending more complicated expressions as well, where you can do more than a path, like, you know, because even an X path, right, you also have filters and little projections and so on?
So absolutely. I mean, obviously what you guys have done with Link in the C# world is that you can send very much more complex expressions, right? So the reason why we didn't allow that, and it's sort of what we're doing is we have a pattern that we're applying on the server. And so if you think about REST, right, REST is very explicit about the resource that's coming back. And so you're going to have a caching strategy that's very fine-grained in the sense that it's as fine-grained as the resource. So every single time you send an URL over the browser, you get data back. But then if you visit the same URL, you get the same data back.
Yep.
The problem with remoting complex expressions, right, that have filters and so on and so forth, is I don't know exactly what resources are going to come back. And you don't even know about the cardinality of those resources.
Yes, yeah.
So then if you just want to, like, part of our goal here was to even hide entirely, or at least come up with a really good default caching strategy for the developer, so they didn't have to think about it, right? Building a caching strategy is one of the more complex things in a client-server application. So what if you could just give them a good default, which is basically, whatever you've pulled, we'll hold on to it, we'll give it back to you next time, and we'll put those resources in an LRU, a least recently used, queue, and you can give us a maximum size, and we'll just keep the local client fragment of that domain model to that maximum size.
That makes sense.
And so, but to make that work, you have to be explicit about the resources going in and out. And so what we've essentially done is it's very similar to REST in the sense that, except it's a path through a graph, a JavaScript object, right? And so by doing that, we always know exactly what resources are coming back. And so you can make that cache transparent. You never cache the same object twice, right? If you were to come up with a naive caching approach for a link query, you might just sort of take the link query and hash it together and use that as a key. Mm-hmm. But then I might send two or three different link queries that all end up caching the same object. And then I have multiple sources of truth, and then I have to worry about stale data, and so on and so forth. And so the way that works is, because obviously you need to be able to do filters and projections. Well, the idea is every time you're crossing a network boundary, push that work to the server.
Okay.
Do it there. And what you end up with is a view model So for those watch few people who are familiar with the model view view model pattern.
A view model is something for UI. What crazy things are you doing, Jafar?
Right. Well, so if you know, it is typically viewed as a UI pattern.
Yes,
and if you go to Wikipedia and you look up model view view model or presentation model, which
and
is
Wikipedia
Fowler's.
Is always right.
Right. Well, in my talk here, I excerpt a little section of the Wikipedia page, which I believe is really exactly is the essence of what a view model is, which is it translates a model to a translates data in a model to another kind of model that's convenient for consumption for a view.
Yep.
And so, actually, I like what David Lieb says when I was here. He prefers that the pattern be renamed MV star because a view model is really just another model.
Yeah.
So all you do is, I mean, you don't need a controller, right? All you do is you have a model and then you transition that model for easier consumption via view and you can just keep doing that. And it makes sense to do that at the network boundary for that specific reason. You can be explicit about the resources going in, and you can have a fine-grained caching strategy.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, and because you're just building a big pipeline of transformations, it makes perfect sense. And so now on the server side, are you writing everything in JavaScript, or is that?
You know, I would prefer that, but the truth is, we're a Java shop. And we have some really, really talented Java developers. But one thing we did do is because we recognized the need for, I think, higher level types of programming than was available in Java. What our great team of developers on the server side did is they said, you know what, we're going to embrace Groovy, which is a language that actually, I mean, it's sort of like it's Java +++ in the sense that it essentially keeps the Java syntax. And adds closures and a variety of other dynamic elements.
Yeah.
So we already have a language that we're using on the server that we could, for example, implement Rx in, and we could use Rx, and in fact, that's exactly what we're doing now.
Okay, that's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, we've got a really talented developer, Ben Christensen, who's focusing on an Rx port for Groovy. And so, just as I said, we're going to do all that map and filtering on the server side, right? What's the perfect tool for that? Rx.
Yeah.
So Ben's working on that port right now, and I think you're going to start to see us rewrite the server portion of our data access framework, which is essentially just taking paths, just like a typical web server where URLs come in, you execute some code, and you return a result. Now we're taking paths, executing some code, returning a result. You're going to see Rx power that side as well.
Wow, that's incredibly cool. Well, Rx everywhere, so we can enjoy our movies thanks to Rx. And oh, look at this.
No worries.
Look at this. Was this push or pull? I think.
Who knows?
Oh, no. The gravity is pulling. Yes. Okay. Well, maybe the Earth should be turned into RX too.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jafar.
Yeah. Thanks.
And good.
Keep rocking on.
Yes. Thanks. Keep rocking.
By,
yes. Okay.
Killer.